well said. Now, there's an area adjacent to the Pacific Ocean. Now, the area had been originally built to about plus 12 feet above mean lower low water. Now, the subsidence effects, it went down 29 feet at the center of the bowl. That meant that it was subtracting 12 feet from that it would be 17 feet below mean low water. So that meant that the whole ocean could come in if it weren't protected. Now, its maximum rate in 1951 was 2.36 feet per year. That's 28 3/8 inches per year. Almost 2.5 feet. Now, it started in about 1940, and I mentioned how George Gardner came about finding it, and it was stopped by 1968, and it was handled by unitizing the oil field. That meant the whole oil field was made into one big unit. Now, there are, what is it, seven zones and five main fault blocks, I think. So there's about 35 different areas that had to be unitized and had to be have water injected into them, and had to have the bottom air pressures brought up to a degree that they no longer would sink. Now, to begin with, the oil companies didn't want to admit, and they still, as far as I know, never admitted that subsidence caused by oil.
Right.
And so it was a very difficult time to get the oil companies to come in together and to do anything, because it was going to cost them money, and in fact they didn't do anything until it was proved that secondary recovery by injecting water would pay for itself and in turn stop subsidence. And along with this vertical movement, we had horizontal movement, because it's a flat plate type thing where you put a weight on it, and that would cause the land all to stretch or to shrink, depending on the shape that the plate took. So this meant that all boundary lines were all changed, because some spots had moved as much as 20 feet, as I remember. And this means that they haven't done it yet, but someday somebody's got to go in, and all this area that was part of the subsiding bowl, they're going to have to go in and resurvey it and clear title on it all again, because some areas are much larger than they should be, and others are much smaller than they should be, and so that this has to be taken care of sometime. I don't know when they'll do it. We had oil well damage to the casings, because down in the ground where, because the it's just like a beam, so that the one strata would move with relationship to another strata and would shear the pipelines off, so they had problems like that. We had small earthquakes and a lot of nuisance items besides the area going down to a total of, I think, 29 feet there at the Edison plant. Now, we had a lot of studies made on subsidence while we were doing all of this. In 1940, we hired Dr. U.S. Grant up at UCLA to study it. In 1944, the Edison Company and the Harvard Department hired a board of geologists, of which U.S. Grant was one. The Navy hired Frederick R. Harris, and both underestimated the amount of future subsidence, because they were going down maybe 8 feet, and then it would be 14 feet, and then more. In 1948, subsidence was way past both Grant and Harris's estimates, and county property owners employed the Stanford Research Group to make the study. Now, Stanford Research came down here, and we took a trip through the port, and these people looked at everything we had, and they were more interested in how many oil wells we had and how much money we had coming in. So they made a very fine report, and we had the fellow named a soil mechanics man, a very fine man. He was the dean of the soil mechanics people, Dr. Terzaghi. And he read the report, and he said it was the finest bound report he'd ever had seen. That was, anyway, that's all we could get out, and that cost us a young fortune for the Stanford Research Group.
And the harbor paid for that?
Oh, yes. Well, the harbor and 20 property owners employed Stanford Research Group. But anyway, that was really something. In 1949, we got Dr. G.D. McCann of Caltech. And the last studies indicated subsidence might reach 35 feet to 42 feet at the center. But before we got to that far, we started to injecting water. Now, how is subsidence combated? First, by diking. We built dikes like all around the Edison plant over there. They put dikes in, and then they put well points. Now, the well points means that you put a pipe down the ground that you can pump the water from the ground just like you do with a well. And they put, so if they would pump any seawater that was coming in under the dikes, they took and built, they put a clay core in the dikes all around the Edison Company in Southern Pacific, Union Pacific property, so the seawater couldn't come under the dikes, and then they pumped the water out and gradually got it down and controlled. Other places we raised the areas. Now, where we had to operate a port, you couldn't very well bring a ship in where the wharf was very low and things like that, so that in the port district, where we had port works, where we had to raise the streets, the railroad tracks, and the wharves, and the transit sheds, and the utilities, and the oil wells. From 1950 to 1960, the port spent $53 million on port facility raising. Now, this did not include the cost of raising the oil wells, but $53 million. Now, I talked about how this actually stopped subsidence in the past, but actually what worked was the water flooding the oil wells. The bottom air pressures must be maintained or the land will continue subsiding. Now, to sit present time, this has to continue, and it will have to continue long after these wells are producing. And there's some money in the state funds. I think the subsidence reserve fund is $40 million, and I understand that the Harbor Department has made a deal with the State Lands Commission here lately, but this is something that has to be watched very carefully, because once the oil field is gone, and there's no more oil money coming in, that oil field has to be cleaned up. And as all those oil wells have to be done away with, they have to be plugged. This costs money. Got to clean out all the pipelines and clean up the oil field. And the state isn't going to do it. That's been proved time after time. The state's not going to spend a dime on it. And so that there's got to be money set aside, and there has to be, the city has to realize that this is going to have to be cleaned up. And with the money all going to the state now, virtually, the state's going to spend it. And they're a long ways from Long Beach. And so that we've got to be sure that something is set up such that this oil field, first, that we will maintain the bottom hole pressure so there's no more subsidence, and two, that all that the oil field is cleaned up such that it can be used for other purposes.
Where did the idea for the water injection come from?
Did
you come from one of those reports?
Oh, yes. The geologists and the petroleum engineers who weren't working for oil companies would state that this could be done. The oil companies wouldn't allow their geologists or petroleum engineers to say a word because they weren't going about to admit that oil was the cause of subsidence. Now, were they going to make any overtures toward stopping subsidence or doing anything that might indicate that they had any legal reason or that anybody could sue them or that they had to pay for any cleanup or any of the damages caused by subsidence.
It seems like the port would be anxious to promote some kind of solution since they're passing millions and millions.
The port was the one who was pushing as much as it possibly could, but nobody was interested. And when I say nobody, I mean the city of Long Beach didn't care. The state, of course, they wanted just the money. The federal government we were fighting in those days, all they wanted was money. In fact, during the war, knowing the subsidence was, we had subsidence, and the federal government wanted oil for the war, so they wanted that area developed and that oil pumped. So that it just depends on who wants certain things at certain times, and so that this was a situation, and wasn't a good situation, and it wasn't until the harbor department just by pushing and hammering and finally brought about the harbor had put in the first water injection wells, the pioneer ones, the ones to prove that it would work, and they kept hammering and working to get the area unitized so that you could water inject, and everybody got their fair share of oil, and so that the Harbor Department was the leader in every one of these things. Nobody else cared. And so it's this was a situation.
Yeah. Was it just that the oil companies thought it would cost extra money to do this? And
the oil companies didn't want any liability.
Yeah.
They didn't want to have to spend one dime that they didn't have to. They're no different from anybody else. They're not going to spend any money that they don't have to. And so this is just the situation.
Yeah. I think when you talked about the Historical Society, you said that there were two or three men who were instrumental in building the post, the harbor, in the form that it is now, the whole island.
Yeah, okay.
And were they the leaders in
yes.
water injection?
Yes. They were, because, again, I'll go back and we'll talk a little bit about this. Beginning in 1939 and 40, and continuing for 20 years or thereabouts, the story of the port is the story of three men. Frosty Martin, who was president of the board, L.R. Amar, who was the port manager, and R.R. Shoemaker, who was the chief engineer. In 1939, the board met, joined the city manager's office, and five new men came back to the port as the new board, with Frosty Martin as president. He was president for the following about 16 years, thereabouts. In February of 1940, Amar was appointed the port manager. In late 1939, Shoemaker was appointed chief engineer. I don't remember exactly when he came there. Now, Foster Martin was an oil man. He was rich, and he owned the Independent newspaper. Now, the Independent is the forerunner of the Independent Press Telegram. But he owned, and he was a strong and tough man, and he had a editorial writer there on the Independent that was very vitriolic. I've forgotten his name. I still see it sometimes now. He's still writing, but I think it's the same fellow. Elroy Amar was a native San Pedran. He spoke several languages. He was the former president of the L.A. Harbor Board, and he was a salesman and a front man for the group. R.R. Shoemaker was a former engineer at L.A. Harbor, and he was a brain. And so those three, I call them the triumvirate. And they were the three men who pushed the harbor for the first, we'll say 16 years. Because without their push, I don't think we would have had the port. How do you sell the facilities and services of a new port in a situation like this? Well, you've got to build a better mousetrap. And so that they prepared a master plan of a port with land masses, water depths, width of channels, and protected berths that fit the needs of present and future shipping. And so that they hired George Nicholson and Jim Collins, who came up with the 1940 master plan. Now, George Nicholson had been the chief engineer at L.A., a very fine engineer. I knew him very well. Jim Collins was the brother of Collins, who was at the newspaper. Now, we had to build port facilities to fit the needs of the shippers such that cargoes could be handled quicker and cheaper through the port. So we built all concrete wharf structures. Now, a little side on this. The Port of L.A. recently had studies made for a new wharf design. The result was similar to the designs which we came up with in 1945. We came up with clear-span transit sheds. We had three widths, 120, 116, 200 foot. We built nine sheds to serve 17 berths between 1946 and 1963. Now, these transit sheds were copied all over the world. Miami, Florida, they're identical. L.A. has similar ones. I could point to facilities all over the country that were using our stuff. Now, cargo costs were about one half as much over our new facilities as they were over the old facilities, the old timber facilities with the small transit sheds with their columns and the usual thing. Because at L.A., most everything over there was built World War One or right after the 1914 Panama Canal deal and things like that. And I'll tell a story on Frosty Martin. Frosty Martin was had the Martin Decker Company, and they made gauges. And Frosty was just talking one day, and he said, "Now I make gauges, and I don't remember the exact amount of money, but I just to give you an idea of what it is." He says, "Now these gauges cost me $10 to make." He says, "I put them in a box that costs $100, and I sell them for $1,000. Now, what kind of transit sheds are you fellas going to build? And this was, his whole idea was that for us to build something that was sellable. So that we built, we designed these wharves and these transit sheds to fit the needs of the shippers at that time and for some years to come. And although they weren't the cheapest, they're still standing in good shape. They're obsolete now, of course, because of the fact that cargo handling has changed. But they were the reason that people came to the Port of Long Beach, because if you build a better mousetrap, people will come to your door. Yes, that's the story. I've forgotten exactly. But the whole idea was that we would have built first-class facilities, and then we would have gone out and sell them, and that's what was done. And so these three men really were the push behind the port. Now, after all, there were a lot of other people there. They did an awful lot of work, because one individual or three individuals can do everything. But they were the people who pushed the port and caused it to become what it was. Shoemaker died in 57, I think, because I think he died in August of 57, and I became chief engineer in February of 58. And he had been home for about a year. He had a heart attack, and so that I would go see him every Friday night, Friday afternoon. We'd talk about what had been happening, and so that he'd keep me straight as to what should be going on, and so that from 1940, we'll say, to 57, or a period of 17 years, why Shoemaker was the chief engineer. Amar retired a year, I think, after I became chief engineer. And Frosty died in there, and I don't remember just exactly when, but Frosty was still on the board, I remember, when I was hired. Yes, I'm sure he was. But I think he went off the board and died shortly afterwards.
So when you became chief engineer, how much of this was built and how much did you supervise?
In 58, there was no Pier F, G, or J. There was piers A, B, and C. Pier 1 on the inner harbor. Some of Pier E, but none of the outer harbor had been built. None of the outer harbor had been built. So that
so you were the one who designed and built all of that?
Oh, yes. I was responsible for it, let's put it that way.
Well,
because there's a lot of other people, you know, good men down there, do their business. So that
so you built the extension of Pier E that I learned a good deal about.
Yes, I did. That's right. Let's see. Because they're sacred cells out there on Pier E. I built them, I think, and the wharf that's now part of the Navy over there, I think I built that. I was assistant chief harbor engineer. Of about 7 years, so since about 1950. So that it's, I don't remember clearly when some of these things happened. After all, it's a long time ago. That's 32 years ago, 1950. And because here, well, let's just look. I've got some of the stuff here. Now, we couldn't go south of the stipulated line, which was right down through the middle of Pierre, that goes northeast and northwest and southeast, northeast, south, southwest. We couldn't go outside of that until 1953, when Eisenhower signed the bill settling the Taiwan dispute. Mm-hmm. So we started planning there then for the southeast expansion. That's with the studies on Pier J down in Vicksburg. So that
I have a question.
Yeah.
Apparently, when they built the marina at Alamitos Bay,
yes,
they didn't go to Vicksburg. They
no.
went their own.
That's right.
How come you went to Vicksburg and didn't use that kind of?
Well, because first. The marina was inside, was not out in the outer ocean, one thing. So that you weren't working directly with the Corps. But, and it was all under one jurisdiction, that is under City of Long Beach. But this out here, we were working with L.A. Harbor and Port of Long Beach, as well as with the Corps of Engineers on the breakwaters. So that Vicksburg was a natural place to go. And I still think Vicksburg's a natural place to go, even though we here at Moffett and Nickel had a tank down there, down at 3rd and Alamitos, where the old skating rink used to be, where we could make studies there.
I heard about that. For a fire inspector.
Yeah.
That's very nice to know.
Yeah. And Tech up in Pasadena has a tank up there. There's a tanks up others around there for smaller things. But with the Corps having to be the final, making the final judgment on these things, they're going to want to go and make their own studies anyway. Mm-hmm. So you might as well let them do it in the first place. And that's why now, you know, we have a model of all of course, Long Beach and LA down at Vicksburg, so that we can study anything that's being built. And so that I think it's natural to go to Vicksburg. They've got the experts there, so it's better, I think, than to try to do it locally. So. So after we got the studies at Vicksburg, why the landfills were to proceed as rapidly as money was available. And so 1958 to 1960, Piers F and G, Basin 6 had the 10 berths in there, you know, inside that. Now this is what changed the port from a general cargo port into a its present day port of handling not only general cargo, but bulk and containers, because the first facility to handle containers was out there on Pier G, out on the end of Pier G, on south of what where now the coal and coke terminal is. Also, we had the grain terminal in there, we had the banana terminal, we had the salt terminal, and we built the last transit shed there on Pier F. The last clear span. But this was the turning point in the port. Because at that place, the port changed from being a general, break bulk general cargo terminal into a bulk port and a container port. Then in 62, we built Pier J. Pier J and the extension to Pier F. And that was the southeast basin with 16 berths out there. And that was the beginning of making the port into one of the finest container ports in the country. was in 61, we built the grain terminal, 62, the iron ore terminal, 63, the salt batch facility, 63, the container terminal at berth 214 and 15, which was Sea Lion, and that was the beginning of Sea Lion's big push. 64, the transit shed at Pier F, berth 206 and 7, the last transit shed we were to build. 1965, we built a banana terminal. 1960, we built the Arco terminal at berth 118, 19. 52 feet of water, the first supertanker terminal in the country.
Is that the one on Peary?
Peary, yeah. First supertanker.
I'm really a Peary expert.
Yeah.